So basically, I'm going to talk for about 15 minutes, and we're going to hear a few elephant stories, and I'll talk a little bit about the symbolism of elephants, and then we'll have a bit of time for discussion, and hopefully we'll have time as well at the end to end with another just sitting, maybe about 10 minutes or so. It's basically the shape of the second half. So as I said at the start of this evening, so the stories of the Pali Canon, they're quite vivid. They're very vivid and site-specific. They talk about places where the Buddha actually wandered around with his followers. They talk about specific people he taught in those places. And they're full of what maybe now would be called by ecologists the more than human beings as well. You know, so they're full of communications not only with other human beings, but with the landscape, with trees, with animals. So the Buddha and his followers were in quite direct and lively communication and interaction with those non-human beings, because they were living right amongst nature, in nature, outside, and that's how we all originally lived. So I heard quite an interesting talk. It was quite a few years ago now. It was when one of those, I think, all Buddhist conventions. And it was by Stephen Batchelor, who is a Buddhist scholar. And he was saying during this talk, he'd just written a book, I think, about this particular aspect of the Buddha's teachings, of being in particular places and being site-specific. And he admitted that for years he had quite impatiently skipped over the parts of the stories, the early stories, where it was sort of meticulously describing landscapes, plants, animals. He'd considered them quite irrelevant, and he was superfluous, and he wanted to get to the point of the actual teaching, the gist of the teaching. But then something, I can't remember what had happened, and it captured his interest in just those features of the stories, and he started focusing on that. And he was quite astonished, he said, to find that this change of attitude quite deepened his understanding of the teachings in a way that he was unable to quite articulate, and he couldn't quite make sense of it. And he thought it had something to do with getting a sense of the Buddha being an actual historical being, and these being lived and living truths, the teachings, that they were real in a way, more real, not just abstract and intellectual. He had always focused on that aspect before. And I found that really interesting, because for me too, it's always felt quite important that the Buddha, as well as being this mythical figure that we see on the shrine and, you know, we emulate sort of the qualities that he developed, he was an actual historical person living in a particular place and a particular time, and he developed wisdom and compassion through his own struggles and in his everyday life. He wasn't an abstract universal god, and that makes a big difference. And as I said, when I went on pilgrimage, it was particularly strong seeing other people on pilgrimage to actually go to the places and sort of realise he was actually there, actually teaching people. It makes really sort of like the touching the earth, you know, this really happened. And it makes you then more confident, made me a bit more confident. Oh, well, so we could do this too, you know, if you just develop your mind enough, you can change and you can develop these qualities. He did it. Yes, and then also, as I said at the first half, at the moment, you know, I mean, I think quite a lot about how many species are at the moment at the brink of extinction, you know, and how much in the city we've lost contact. We're not no longer really have that natural feeling for nature. I have a little bit because I grew up in a very small place, and I can get it very quickly again when I go to a natural place, but some people who've been born in the city and have never had that can't easily access that connection, and it's so important to find a way of reconnecting emotionally with this more than human world, both animals and the landscape and particular places with all their richness and importance. So that's what made me think it would be good to start our series of early Buddhism with these, with some delightful elephant stories and the metaphors tonight. Okay. So looking at the Buddha's life chronologically, the first time an elephant appeared was when his mother was pregnant with him, And she dreamed of a white elephant entering her body and womb from the side. And that was a mythical sign. So she woke up and she knew that she would give birth to a great being. So white elephants were very much revered in India at the time, and dreams had particular meanings, and this dream had a meaning that, you know, this was going to be a great being. She was pregnant. And if you look closely, I'm actually going to pass this elephant around. This is one of the elephants that I put on the shrine, and it's from the deer park in Sarnath, where the Buddha gave his first teaching. And it's a very elaborately carved elephant with a little elephant inside it. So it's sort of, I think, plays on this particular symbolism. The wondrousness of white elephants. White elephants are very rare, so they were regarded as particularly special. So it shows a small elephant carved inside a big one. And actually, around it was an egg shape. Unfortunately, that broke in my suitcase. I brought them from the pilgrimage. So it is sort of around that birth symbolism and elephants within elephants. And the Buddha himself was sometimes referred to as the great tusker, like tusks are a mighty elephant in the early stories. So in these images, the size of the elephant is likened to the size and the significance of the Buddha's great mind, you know, like a great elephant. And one verse from an early sutta reads, "Just as the footprints of all animals can fit within the footprint of an elephant, so too, whatever wholesome states there are, all of them are embraced by the Four Noble Truths." So just the size of an elephant and the size of the teachings in the significance. And the elephant also appears in the description of the dhyanas, the progressively blissful and happy mental states that we can reach through meditation. So a state of rapture, when we're sort of physically very blissful, is described as like a big elephant plunging into a small pleasure pool with the water splashing all around. I always love that image. And then with the water splashing all around, and then bliss, which is the next state, a sort of more subtle state, is described as like a big elephant plunging into a deep and large pleasure pool and only causing a few ripples. So both of them are compared with elephants. And another story emphasizes particularly the size as well as the complexity of an elephant. And it compares it to the significance and complexity of the Buddha's teachings. So this was a group of followers came to the Buddha, and they were asking him, they were having a problem because a lot of their group of people, they were disagreeing and arguing and saying, oh, is this the Dharma, is that the Dharma? They were all disagreeing about the teachings and not quite understanding them and arguing with each other about them. And they said to the Buddha, why is this happening, you know, about your teachings? If your teachings are all true, why are we all arguing about them and getting confused about them? And so the Buddha said, oh, bring all the blind people of this village together and bring an elephant, show them an elephant. Mm-hmm. And they put an elephant in the middle, and the blind people were they put the blind people around it, and so they were touching the elephant at different parts, some of them at the tail, some of them at the head, some of them at the body, some of them at the feet. And then when they'd sort of had a good sort of feel of the, must have been a very friendly elephant, a very patient one, the Buddha asked, okay, so tell me, you know, what's an elephant like? And then, you know, the people who were touching the head said, oh, it's just like a massively big bowl. And the ones that were at the tail said, oh, it's like a broom. The ones that were touching the feet were saying it's like a great big trunk of a tree, you know. So they were all saying completely different things. And he said, it's like that with the teaching. If you just look at one particular teaching, you can't possibly understand it. You have to sort of look at the wider perspective and the whole thing. So one of my favourite, quite humorous stories focuses on the love of solitude and peace and quiet that both the Buddha and an elephant share. And this is actually true. One of my friends, when she heard that I was giving a talk about elephants, she gave me quite a factual book, which is called The Life and Lore of Elephants. And in that book, it says that elephants really do, you know, quite often, in fact, the big bull elephants, you know, elephants are in big herds quite often, but very large leading bull elephants often take themselves off from the herd and actually wander around alone. And the Buddha, you know, having been sort of, yes, compared to like a large elephant, was doing the same sometimes. You know, he was, there were all his monks around him, and monks and nuns and all his followers, and sometimes it got a bit much and he wanted to have a bit of peace and quiet. So in this particular story, he'd got quite fed up with his followers that he was with making a lot of noise, creating such a lot of noise, and he was a bit grumpy, and he'd taken himself off into the forest and was sitting on this rock for a bit of a rest, and there was this elephant sitting on the rock. And in the story, the elephant and the Buddha are having a conversation where they commiserate with having to lead such large herds of people or elephants, and then making such a lot of noise and commotion, and then sometimes wanting to be on their own and preferring that. I love that. And another story describes in quite some details how elephants were tamed and used as kind of prestigious riding and pack animals by kings in India at the time of the Buddha, or part of the story goes into that. So I was just thinking, where's Serena? Serena will read you just an extract from this story. It's an evocative story, it's got many parts to it, but we'll focus tonight just on the part that deals with quite a lot of elephants.
King Ajatasattu, as was often the case, was restless and anxious one evening, not sure what to do and seeking distraction. He asked his advisor Jivaka for advice, and he said, "Your Majesty, there is the Buddha, worthy and rightly self-awakened, unattained trainer of tameable people, staying in my mango grove with a large community of monks just now. 1,250 monks in all. Your Majesty should visit him. Perhaps, if you visited him, he would enlighten and bring peace to your mind." "Then in that case, friend Jivaka, have the riding elephants prepared." Then the king, having had 500 of his women mounted on the 500 female elephants, one on each, and having mounted his own personal tusker, set out from the capital in full royal state with attendants carrying torches, headed for the mango grove. But when the king was not far from the mango grove, he was gripped with fear, trepidation, his hair standing on end. Fearful, agitated, his hair standing on end, he said to Jivaka, "Friend Jivaka, you aren't deceiving me, are you? You aren't betraying me, are you? You aren't turning me over to my enemies, are you? How can there be such a large community of monks, 1,250 in all, with no sound of sneezing, no sound of coughing, no voices at all?" "Don't be afraid, great king, don't be afraid. I'm not deceiving you or betraying you or turning you over to your enemies. Go forward, great king, go forward. Those are lamps burning in the pavilion hall." Then the king, going as far on his tusker as the ground would permit, dismounted and approached the door of the pavilion on foot. On arrival, he asked Jivaka, "Where, friend Jivaka, is the Blessed One?" "That is the Blessed One, great king, sitting against the middle pillar, facing east, surrounded by the community of monks." Then the king approached the Blessed One, and, on reaching him, stood to one side. As he was standing there, surveying the community of monks sitting in absolute silence, as calm as a lake, he felt inspired to exclaim, "May my son, the prince, enjoy the same peace that this community of monks now enjoys."
And that's quite it's just an extract of the story, but what's always struck me about that story, it's quite interesting to imagine maybe how much commotion this very large group of elephants must have made, you know, going through the forest and to the mango grove, you know, in contrast to then the Buddha and his monks sitting there in absolute silence. And that was one of the things that struck him. And the whole preparation of just having to saddle all these elephants, it wasn't simple, really. But then the other thing I was thinking when I was reading that again, it was a bit that I read in my factual book. Although elephants are so large, One of the things that they're really known for is that the soles of their feet are very, very sensitive. Right. And actually, they can walk very, very quietly and softly and without creating a lot of disturbance through places as well. So that's quite an interesting paradox as well. This looks like quite a large lumbering animal, but they can actually be incredibly delicate as well. So I want to just move on to the main story for this evening. And that story is of a confused and enraged elephant called Nalagiri. And I found I won't say very much more about the story right now. We actually hear the whole story, which is quite a longish story, and then I'll say a little bit about it at the end. Because I think that story brings out a lot of qualities of the elephant and of the Buddha, and it is just a beautiful story in its own right that stays in your mind. And it gives you a real impression, I think, of the particular style and ambience of a lot of these early stories. So Vilasamani is going to read us the story of Nalagiri and the elephant.
Once there was a great elephant named Nalagiri. When he was a young calf, he was captured and brought to the city to be a tusker in the king's army. King Bimbisara had no elephant in his service equal to Nalagiri, with his massive shoulders, his gleaming tusks, and his ferocious strength. Enraged, he was unstoppable, trampling and crushing everything that lay in his path. All the king's enemies trembled at the sight of Nalagiri, and on rare occasions when he was paraded through the streets of the city, decked in glittering brocade, the people trembled too. They hung back from the roadside or watched from the safety of rooftops. "Mahahati," they whispered, "the great elephant, Nalagiri." Once, Nalagiri was startled by a dog barking in an alleyway and began stampeding through the streets. His great feet fell like thunderbolts, shook the earth and raised a cloud of dust. Nalagiri was frightened and ran to ease his panic. But the people, seeing the great elephant on the loose, fled in terror for their lives. When Nalagiri saw them running, he lifted his trunk and trumpeted, swung his tusks from side to side, and knew that he inspired fear. Thereafter, his legs were bound with chains and his keepers took to giving him 8 measures of palm wine every day. And so he spent his hours in a bewildered haze, like a smouldering fire that only needs a bit of fuel to set it ablaze. At that time, the Buddha often dwelt at Valuvan, the bamboo grove, the sanctuary offered to him by King Bimbisara, which lay at the root of the foot of the mountain known as the Vulture's Peak. The Buddha and the monks would go on alms round into the city nearby, and there they received offerings from the king and the people. The Buddha had already been teaching for many years and had many supporters and followers. The Buddha had 2 cousins, both members of the ordained Sangha. One was Ananda, the Buddha's faithful attendant. The other was Devadatta, who had easily attained the siddhi, the psychic powers, soon after becoming a monk, and believed himself to be equal to the Buddha in attainment. When he saw how the Buddha was honoured by princes and kings, he too wished to receive this kind of honour. 3 times he asked the Buddha to give the community of the monks into his care. 2 times the Buddha refused. 3rd time he said, "Devadatta, I will not give over the Sangha, not even to my worthy disciples, Sariputta and Moggallana, and certainly not to you." Devadatta went away, humiliated and angry. He enlisted the support of Prince Ajatasattu, the son of King Bimbisara, to bring about the death of the Buddha. One night, Devadatta gained admission to the king's elephant stables. He bargained with Nalagiri's keepers, promising them gold and honour if they would double the daily ration of palm wine they gave to Nalagiri. 8 measures is what you give him? Well, then give him 16. And when he has drunk it all, open the doors of the stable, unbind his chains, and stick him and prick him with your goads and spears until, mad with anger, he charges into the road, onto the path of the Buddha. The elephant keepers nodded, their eyes caught by the glint of gold shining in the torchlight. But when Devadatta had gone, one of the keepers slipped away in the shadows and went to Valavain to warn the Buddha. The Buddha knew of Devadatta's plan, and he had no fear. The monks, however, counseled him not to go on alms round. The Buddha said, "Do not fear. A Buddha cannot be killed in such a way." The news spread throughout the city that the next morning the Buddha would tame the king's great tusker, Nalagiri. Others announced with satisfaction that the great elephant would trample that recluse mendicant, the Shakyan, to death. When morning came, the people had gathered on rooftops to watch the spectacle. The streets of Rajgaha were empty, except for the odd cart laden with fruit or garlands, hastily abandoned by its owner. Dogs roamed and crows settled expectantly in the banyan trees. The morning air was heavy with anticipation. In the elephant stables, Nalagiri's keepers finished emptying the 16 measures of palm wine into his drinking trough. Nalagiri began to drink, sucking up the liquid in his trunk and pouring it into his open mouth. As he drank, his keepers moved quietly about, opening the doors of the stable, unfastening the chains that bound the elephant's legs, and selecting their sharpest goads and spears. The Buddha was just entering the city as Nalagiri raised his head, sensing something different in his surroundings. Through the open doors of the stable, the smells of the city drifted in. The smoke of cooking fires, the sweet smell of jasmine, the dusty street. Nalagiri lifted one foot, then another, and slowly turned himself about. He blinked at the sight of so much daylight. He raised his trunk to take in all the smells. Where were his keepers? Where was his mahout? Why were the doors open? Suddenly, he felt a jab on his left hind leg, then on his right. Pain shot through him. As he turned his head, he was besieged with stabbings on all sides. He heaved his massive form from one side of the stall to the other, crushing two of the keepers, breaking the legs of a third. Then he charged into the street, lifting his great trunk and trumpeting. The first thing he saw was the garland seller's cart with its wreaths of jasmine. Nalagiri reached out, wrapped his trunk around the shaft, seizing the cart, turning it upside down, smashing the wooden frame and trampling the flowers. Next he came upon a row of neem trees. One by one, with astonishing speed, Nalagiri uprooted the trees and heaved them to the ground. Now the dogs came barking behind him. Careering wildly from one side of the street to the other, the charging elephant crashed into tea stalls, knocked down walls, bellowing with rage and hurt and fear. The people shouted from the rooftops, "The elephant is coming! The elephant is coming!" At the city gates, the Buddha and the monks heard the shouting. The monks tried to persuade the Buddha to change his course. "Badante," they said, "turn back, we beg you. Remove yourself from the path of this fearsome beast." The Buddha smiled and motioned them to stand back. Everyone saw the elephant approaching, swaying madly from one side of the road to the other, slamming his weight into market stalls and house fronts. The Buddha's attendant, Ananda, placed himself before his teacher. The Buddha motioned for him to step back. Less than 100 yards down the road, the Buddha saw the charging elephant. The Buddha called up the force of loving kindness from deep within himself, radiating his boundless heart toward Nalagiri. "Ambo," Nalagiri, he said. Come, my friend. The elephant felt something brush against him, like a cool wind. The Buddha radiated the oceanic power of loving kindness towards Nalagiri. Nalagiri's whole life began to unfold before him. His days in the forest as a young calf, playing in rivers and lakes, wandering with his mother and aunt through groves of sal trees. His capture by the king's elephant keepers. The training he went to become a tusker and a slayer of men. His loneliness in the elephant stables. His fear and pain. Like two waves meeting, the force of the Buddha's loving kindness collided with the moving mass of the raging elephant. Nalagiri felt it like a wave breaking against his brow, and his perception cleared. He slowed his charge to a walk. Before him, he saw the shimmering form of a monk in saffron robes. He heard the monk address him. Ambo, Nalagiri, my friend, come. Nalagiri stepped forward, shaking his elephant ears. He bowed his head before the Buddha and knelt upon the ground, bringing his massive weight slowly to the earth. Then he lifted his long, curling trunk, and forming a cup at the end of it, he scooped up a handful of dust from the road and sprinkled it on the bare feet of the monk. The Buddha reached forward with his right hand and laid it on the elephant's brow. Ambo, Nalagiri, he said, you are safe now, my friend.
That's quite a long and but quite a beautiful version of that story, I think, which really brings out, well, it brings out the loving kindness of the Buddha, but also the personality of the elephant, doesn't it, and the complexity of him just being panicked. And I think it beautifully illustrates this story, perhaps the most important recurring theme throughout the early Buddhist stories, which is that of the possibility of following the Buddha's example, that we can try and tame our wild and unhappy and unruly minds, like wild elephants in rut, we're so often sort of, I think that simile occurs again and again, like a wild elephant in rut, we're sort of very much blown about by our desires and by our rage, by our hatred and by our craving. But we can tame those feelings, you know. They're quite out of control, and they're not doing us any good. They're just making us unhappy, and they can be calmed, and we can become more compassionate and wise. And in that way, we can find a kind of true inner refuge, a place of safety and security. And that story just illustrates that very beautifully, I thought. Okay, so leave it there.